are listening to The Activity Pod with Annette Jones and Mel Kettle, where we help you stay focused so you can get stuff done. In today's show, episode 23, we talk to Gabrielle Dolan. Gabrielle is a world leader in business storytelling. I heard her speak at a conference last year, and when she captivated me from her opening sentence, I knew I wanted her as a guest on this podcast. We talked to Gabrielle about setting projects, the importance of using storytelling to win business, to get a job, and to get your staff to understand you. And we talk about how to find stories to share. This was one of my favourite episodes, and not only because I was scribbling notes all throughout our conversation, which is something I don't normally do when we're recording. Gabrielle has also recently launched her online business storytelling program and is generously offering a 20% discount for listeners of the Activity Pod. To take up the offer, use the coupon code 20% discount when you register. And the details are also in the show notes, which you can find at theactivitypod.com/23. That's number 23. This is our second last episode. As we've mentioned over the last few weeks, we've decided to stop recording the Activity Pod. If you haven't listened to all of our back catalogue, then now is a great time to catch up. However, right now, please settle in and listen to our conversation with Gabrielle Dolan. We hope you enjoy listening to it as much as we enjoyed recording it. Thank you.
Welcome to The Activity Pod, where your hosts, Annette Jones and Mel Kettle, talk accountability and focus on helping you get stuff done so you can gain greater freedom to choose what you want to from life. And now, here are your hosts, Annette and Mel.
Our guest today is Gabrielle Dolan. Gabrielle is considered a leading expert on business storytelling. She's an author and highly sought-after mentor and keynote speaker on storytelling and leadership. Gabrielle is also the co-creator and co-chair of the Leadership Connection, a leadership development program specifically designed for senior women to help them address the unique challenges that women face as they progress to the more senior levels of influence. Gabrielle is a partner at Thought Leaders Global, and works with organisations to help them gain the competitive edge with thought leadership. She's had loads of academic qualifications. Mel tells me so many that she didn't want to type them all out. And in 2015 was nominated for Telstra Business Woman's Awards. When not working, she can be found working in her vegetable garden at her rural property on the southern New South Wales coast. Welcome, Gabrielle.
Thank you, and what an introduction. I was wondering who you were talking about there
for a while. That's you.
Yes.
So the first thing we love to know, and we always ask our guests, is how do you fit everything in?
It's a good question. I get asked that a lot because I think when people see me and the things I do, it's like, how do you fit it in? I can be quite efficient when I work. When I'm in the zone, I can get a lot of things done. Mm-hmm. I'm a bit of a morning person, so I find my most productive time is when I get up and can do a bit of work before the kids have got up or after they've left for school. That's a really productive time. Mm-hmm. But I think how I do fit it in is I'm not a time waster, so I don't waste time on things that I don't think add value. So whether that's watching TV, I don't watch a lot of TV at all, through to, you know, having a cleaner to clean the house, not ironing, buying clothes specifically that don't need ironing, things like making the beds. I know there's a lot of people that go, oh, the first thing you should do is get up and make the beds and make the kids' beds. I sort of feel that's why bedrooms have doors, so you can just close.
And I don't think I've made a bed since I left living with my mother when I was 17.
No,
because it's seriously the biggest waste of time.
Yeah. It's easier to close three doors than to make three beds, I figure. So,
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, so I figure out what's important to me and I spend my time doing that, and the things that aren't important and the things that if I didn't do, no one would notice, I tend not to do.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. So you mentioned that you're a morning person. Do you have a morning routine that sets you up for your day?
Probably not so much of a morning routine, although I am one of these people that when the alarm goes off, I get up. So very much I sort of hate it when the alarm goes. My husband used to set the alarm deliberately half an hour earlier when he was in his corporate job. And to go, and because he liked to wake up and then snooze for 10 minutes, and that used to do my head in. So
my husband does that, except his alarm goes off at 5 o'clock. Right, and then lies in bed for half an hour. And it's seriously?
More. So my husband no longer works in a corporate job, and which means the first alarm that goes off is my alarm. So my bit of a ritual is I get up straight away. I try to start the morning. The first thing I ever do is have a drink of warm water with lemon juice in it, or just a warm water if I don't have lemon juice. And then try to have a healthy breakfast. But my daily morning ritual routine is so varied. If I'm traveling, I'm up early on a plane. If I'm working from home, it's just sort of getting the kids ready for school. If I'm delivering that day, it probably still getting the kids ready for school and then leaving. So not much of a daily routine. I tend to have more of a weekly routine where I know Monday, for example, I try to work from home, and Fridays I try to work from home, and I know I need to fit in at least 3 or 4 or 5 gym sessions or runs, and I sort of work my week around them.
I need to get better at doing that. I've recently joined a gym and I absolutely hate it, although it's been so revoltingly humid in Brisbane lately that I've been going to the gym just to use the treadmill so I can walk, because at 5 a.m. this morning it was about 28 degrees and 85% humidity, and the sun had barely even come up. It's like, what?
Right. The gym's a good place to be.
Yeah, not that I went at 5 a.m. this morning, mind you, but it was, I'm sure I thought about it while I was asleep still after my husband's alarm went off at 5 o'clock.
Yeah, I'd like to say it's the thought that counts, but when it comes to
it's not. I'm actually in a Fitbit group. I'm in two Fitbit groups with two groups of friends, most of whom I've never actually met apart from through Fitbit. And it's been really motivating for me just to get up and move, because we challenge each other to do 10,000 steps a day. And one of the groups in particular is so incredibly supportive, and, with comments like, you've only got 1,000 steps to go, why don't you just walk around the house for 10 minutes and you'll get there. And it's just really made a huge difference to my level of exercise.
Yeah. Well, those things do. I mean, it's like when you do anything, when you're trying to do anything, probably the two most important things you need is accountability and support. And from what you're describing, that's exactly what you're getting.
Exactly. So a little while ago, you wrote a book, or co-wrote a book, called Eliminate Death by PowerPoint.
I did. That was quite a long time ago.
That title. What I can have a guess as to what prompted that, but can you tell us what prompted that?
Oh, look, I spent my entire working life in the corporate world. So I was at the National Australia Bank for 17 years, and I left there about 11 years ago, but I predominantly work with clients, and I experienced just the absolute, death by PowerPoint, that the way we communicate with PowerPoint is so – it's just not done in an engaging way. And I shouldn't say the PowerPoint itself is bad. It's a systemic poor use of it. And unfortunately, that's 95% of the time. So I'm on a bit of a, almost a professional crusade to change the way we communicate. And one of the things is to get rid of PowerPoint. Yeah. Or to, if you're going to use PowerPoint, use it properly. I still use PowerPoint or Keynote when I'm doing large keynote presentations, because it's almost you don't have to, but I do. But they would consist of a picture and one or two words normally. Yeah. So I saw the frustration from the people having to sit through PowerPoint presentations, and then I saw the frustrations of the leaders delivering them, getting really frustrated that people didn't understand what they were saying. And that's why I sort of got into storytelling too, is to provide another way to deliver your messages. So that book, it must be about 8 years ago. That was sort of the first book I wrote, which started me on a bit of a book writing journey too, which I never thought I would do, but here I am.
How do you write your books? Do you come up with an idea and sit down and just churn it out, or is it methodical? Or
look, there's different ways. So the second book I co-wrote was Hooked. That was almost like about a four-year journey. We wrote it. We actually wrote it when the GFC hit and all our work stopped. So we thought we'd write a book, and then it sat there for 18 months not doing anything. And then we, you know, decided we should do something with it and contacted a publisher, Wiley, who were interested. And then you looked at your book, and you know when you look at something you've written ages ago and you just go, oh my God, that's really bad. We sort of had to rewrite that book and went through the process. So the Hooked took years, literally. The next book I wrote by myself, Ignite, which was released just in August last year, I had this concept. I knew I wanted to write a book around authentic leadership, about being real and being prepared to communicate in a way that was real. And I sort of started and wasn't really coming together. And as part of Thought Leaders Global, which you mentioned I'm a partner of, we conduct what we call Thought Leaders Business School, where people like myself who are running their own practice come together and in this program. And every quarter we come together for 3 days. One of the things we do at that end is set ourselves challenges, and it's a really supportive network. And someone set a challenge of they're going to write 50,000 words in 50 days, and they stood up and declared it. And then the challenge is, who would like to join me? And I stood up and put my hand up. So I decided that's it. I've committed to it, and it's the game we're playing. And so I sat down and wrote 50,000 words in 50 days. And I just, mind you, I probably already had about 10 or 15, so it probably really wasn't 50,000. But I just got up then. I would get up about 5:30 and write for an hour before anyone else rose, and then the kids would get up and I'd have a bit of a break, and then as soon as they went to school, I'd sit there and write for another hour. And it's amazing what you can get done when you've got that dedication.
Annette and I are both big fans of a man called Darren Rouse, and he's known as ProBlogger. So you may have heard of him. Yeah. And he talked about at his ProBlogger conference a couple of years ago how he wrote a book in 15 minutes a day. Yeah. And it took him about 3 months to write it, but he said he had this great idea for a book that he thought was a great idea, and he faffed around for about a year, and then someone challenged him to do it, and he said, well, I can only find an extra 15 minutes in my day every day, so I'll commit to doing 15 minutes a day.
Yep.
And he wrote this book, and within the first 24 hours after he launched it, it sold 70,000 copies.
Wow.
Online.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah. And so, or $70,000, I think, $70,000 in the first 24 hours. And he instantly kicked himself and said, if I'd known it was going to be that successful, I would have written it 2 years ago when I first had the idea. Mm. But then he said it may not have had that success 2 years ago.
Because 2 years ago, you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of it's time and place. And
But I think the key is to, you know, set yourself a challenge. Like, there's so many people that say, I wish I could write a book. I'd love to write a book. And you go, so what are you doing about it? What's your book going to be on? And they're not doing anything about it. And so I just thrive on challenges, if both internal challenges and external. If someone says to me, you can't do that, I'll go, yes, I can. And so just to give you an example, another book I wrote, this was going to be a relatively small book, but I had some work in New Zealand, and I knew I'd be in a plane or waiting to be on a plane for about 12 hours. So I had to fly from Melbourne to Wellington, from Wellington to Auckland, Auckland back to Melbourne in 4 days. And so I had this concept of a book, and so I just declared a challenge to everyone that I'm going to write a book in the air in a week. And I set my own rules that I was only allowed to write either in the lounge waiting for the plane or in the plane. They were my rules. I weren't allowed to write, you know, at the motel room or anywhere else.
Yeah.
And look, I didn't quite get the book done in those days, but I got, you know, I probably got 70% of it done and broke the back of it, which mean just finishing it off then was relatively easy.
Was that the first time you've ever hoped for your flights to be delayed?
Yeah, actually, there was one time it was delayed, and I was actually very excited about it. So it's the one time I'm glad I fly business class.
yeah. I heard you speak last year at the Future of Leadership, and one of the other speakers was Jason Fox. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you heard his presentation, but he talked about setting yourself 3 projects a quarter. And he said it might be learning a new skill, but then it's putting it into practice.
Yeah.
So he said the skill might be learning to cook and the project might be to host a dinner party.
Yeah.
And I absolutely love that concept of setting yourself projects, and, you know, they can be personal or they can be work-related or they can be, you know, whatever you want them to be.
I know Jason quite well. He's part of Thought Leaders.
Oh, he is. Of course he is. Yes.
And he does amazing work. And what another concept Jason believes in is you gamify it. It's like, so yes, once you've set your project, make it a game. So, you know, even me writing a book in the air, I set my own rules because that was the game we're playing. Yes. But yeah, he's absolutely right. And it comes from Peter Cook, who's actually the CEO of Thought Leaders Business School, and he's both at stages been my mentor and Jason's mentor, I know. He's written a big book called Implement, and his concept of the book is you know, what we do things that are either just responses or habits, or they're projects. And the projects are the really hard ones to do. I mean, habits are easy. Responses to something is easy, but the projects are actually really hard, but they're the most rewarding. And I often think, you know, you can go through a year. You know, imagine at the end of the year and you're sitting down, you're at New Year's Eve party, and people go around, so, you know, what have you done this year that you're proud of? And if people are just living in that, I'm doing things out of habit or responding to other people's needs, they just look back in the year and go, I've done nothing. Through the year. But the people who have done projects, and even as Jason has said, you could go, actually, I started to play the guitar, or I went and did a Thai cooking course because I wanted to get better at Thai, or I ran a half marathon, or, you know, I wrote a book, whatever it was. But those projects are hard because they take work, they take commitment, they take an attitude of being prepared to fail, and that's why a lot of people don't do them.
We've interviewed a lot of authors on our podcast, and we were interviewing Anita Heiss last week, who will be on an episode yet to be released, and she said if it was easy, everybody would have a book.
Mm.
And it's just so true, because it's, I think, the harder it is, then the more reward you feel when you have accomplished and achieved.
Yeah, absolutely. It is hard. I mean, it's not only just the writing and the time, but it's you're bearing your soul, you're putting yourself out there.
Exactly.
It's such a nervous moment. You know, I normally write my book, my exec manager will see it, and then the editor will see it, which is all still part of the process. But that moment I give it to someone, it's like, oh my God, it's terrible. It's terrible when you get it back.
And then, you know, there's the comments from your partner and your siblings and your family and your friends. And
then the book launch.
Them saying to you, I see myself in that. How dare you write that?
Oh, no, see, I'm all on authentic, so I actually name them. especially my children. There's so many stories about my children in my books and in my blog posts that my eldest daughter, who's 15, thinks I should pay her $5 and write a blog post about her.
I mention various family members in my blogs all the time, and the only one who ever reads them is my husband. And one of my girlfriends, who's quite good friends with my sister-in-law and my brother, will every now and then ring them and say, you've been mentioned in Mel's blog again, which I think is quite amusing. So now I write things and say, when such and such tells my brother I've written this, I can expect the phone call. So why is storytelling – I'll start that again. Why is storytelling so important?
Look, again, it comes back to how we communicate. I remember when I was working at the NAB, and this was probably going back 15 years, and me and this other woman were running this major, major project, and I said to Meryn, what's the one message you want to get across to your people? And she told me about, you know, this is a really long project, and it's not going away, and they're going to be receiving lots of information about it. But they probably won't listen to it, but they've got to take notice of it, because it's going to impact, and it's going to impact them personally. And I convinced Meryn to share a personal story that she had shared with me, you know, just months earlier, just over lunch or something, just a, you know, random everyday story. And she shared a story with me that in her previous career, she actually used to live in London and work in Dublin, and she'd catch this same flight every Sunday night. And she goes, you know, it was the same Sunday night flight. Everyone would be tired. The hostie would be going through the safety instructions and no one would be listening. And on this one particular flight, there was really bad weather and they had to abort the landing, and the plane went around again, and again they had to abort the landing. And on the third attempt to land, the pilot came over and said, we will make one more final attempt to land. Before we do, we'll go through the safety instructions again. And Meryn said, with that, people were asking questions and looking at the life jacket and checking they could do the best. And I said, why don't you use that story as a bit of a metaphor to say that we get lots of information, and until it's relevant to us, we don't take notice of it. So Meryn did use that story, and it was the first time I saw the impact that it had, the first time I realized the power in sharing a personal story attached to a business message, and not only the impact it had immediately with the people in that room, but they were still referring to it 6 months and 12 months down the track. Wow. And I just remember thinking at the time, there's something in this, there's something in the power of using personal stories attached to a business message. And then literally it would have been, you know, 1 or 2 years later, I left the NAB and I started a practice in teaching leaders how to use personal stories attached to a business message. And now, you know, 10, 11 years ago, it was like, what the hell is that? But now it's widely recognized as a key leadership skill and a really powerful way to communicate and influence. Mm.
We both went to say something then. I'm a trainer, so I have used stories, and I've just wound up 16 years of being in a particular business, and that's how I always train staff with stories.
Yeah,
because they can relate so easy to a story about, you know, Mrs. Brown that isn't feeling that great today, and she comes in and takes all the crap out on you. It's not personal, you know, and I always used to go through sort of stories in that respect.
Yeah, so I've found really good trainers and teachers use stories, and really good salespeople use stories. But the reality is, if you're in a position where you need to communicate effectively and you need to influence people, which is what leadership is, then leaders should be using stories.
Mm. Where are the stories in business? Where can leaders find them? Because I hear that quite often, that, I worked for a large company for a while doing some internal comms, and I would say to them, you need to use stories. And they'd say, but we don't have any. I'm like, well, yes, you do. And it was just, well, they didn't want to share their personal stories. So I was trying, I know, it's a long, hard story. It was a long, hard slog, this job.
Yeah.
And I was often at a loss because I didn't know the business as to say to them, this is where you can get your stories. So where can people find them?
The stories come from within them. When I train leaders, I take them through a process. A lot of leaders have never even thought of the concept of using a personal story in a business sense. So that in itself is new. Mm. And once they realize that, it was, you know, of course I give them the skill, how to start the story, what to put in the middle, how to end it to make sure it's on message. But the thing that they have to be comfortable with is sharing personal stories. Now, when I say personal stories, it's, you know, and I tell them, it's not the most intimate, darkest secrets. It's literally story, you know, like Meryn's story. It's a story about catching a plane. It's the day-to-day ones that make them more powerful. But there has to be some acceptance that a personal story is giving something of myself. And the leaders that do storytelling really well are the leaders that understand showing vulnerability is a strength, not a weakness. Mm. So you just, you know, you can seriously find stories from your past, from when you're a kid, are always really good. Stories about your own kids, but just, you know, anything. A story could happen when you're sitting at the hairdresser's or on the weekend. Right. It's once they understand the power of it, they actually spot stories everywhere, and something will happen and they will go, this is exactly what I could use to get the message across around integrity or teamwork or a change that's coming, whatever it is.
Especially service-based. I mean, we've all been served in a store or a restaurant or a cafe and so forth.
Yeah.
So in retail, I found those sort of stories very, very powerful.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And they can be – those literal stories are quite good where it's, you know, you're trying to share a story around customer service, you tell a customer service story. But a lot of the most powerful stories are the lateral ones that actually have got nothing to do with customer service.
Yeah.
But when you hear it and the storyteller has linked it perfectly to say to get the message across.
I loved your blog post that you wrote, I think it was before Christmas, about using the photos in your iPhone that you've taken to find a story that you can share. That just resonated with me enormously because, you know, particularly because I've got thousands of photos in my iPhone that I, you know, trawl through every now and then looking for a specific thing. And it just evokes memories. That
yeah, evokes absolutely.
Stories that are relevant to lots of different business applications.
That came about, interestingly, I was doing some one-on-one work with a senior exec and I was trying to help him find stories from his past. And I went through a process with him, but he was coming up with really – really good stories, but significant ones, you know, really, you know, the time when he got married or, you know, when he asked to marry someone and they said no, and when he moved countries and all these really big significant events in his life, which can be powerful, that you shouldn't discount them. But what I was trying to get him to do was come up with some day-to-day stories.
Yes.
And I just asked him a few questions and he started sharing a story about, you know, when he took his son, he went camping with his son. And I won't go through the story, but it was a story about trying to be organized where he wasn't organized. Like he thought he was organized. He got there really early and he got the best campsite and all the other dads and kids came and they had the best campsite. And then he pulled out the tent and the poles were missing. So then he shared this story with me and then he pulled out his phone. He goes, I've got a photo of, and it's a photo of him and his son, him and his son looking a bit embarrassed in front of their tent that just is being held up with sticks. And then he started flicking through his photos and he went, oh, actually, here's another one I could use, because I was trying to get him to get stories around the values. And he just came up with all these stories flicking through his camera roll. So I thought, oh, there's another process to find stories.
Yeah. I just loved that. That really resonated with me.
If you're looking for voiceover talent, then get in touch with our voiceover guy, Steve Mendel. Steve is also a consultant, coach and presenter, and you can find him via his website, stevemendel.com.au, and that's S-T-E-V-E-M-E-N-D-L. Thanks, Steve.
How can we use storytelling in job interviews and when pitching for business?
Wow, this is almost like I asked you to ask me.
Can I just say, I got a job once when it was my first job in government after I'd moved to Queensland and I'd been unemployed by choice for a few months and the money was running out and I thought, oh, I better get a job. So I was temping through just a temping agency, just doing data entry and other boring stuff. And one of the women there said to me, there's a great comms job going in this department. You should apply for it. So I did, and I was quite excited, and I turned up to my interview, which was the day after the Australian Open men's final, which went that year until 2:30 in the morning. And so I rock up to my interview a couple of minutes late because I'd overslept and yawning my head off. And fortunately, the person interviewing me was even later. And yawn, and I apologised off the bat and said, I'm so sorry, I'm yawning my head off. I was up all night watching the Australian Open men's final. Wasn't it amazing? Which I said to two tennis haters.
Right.
But I got the job largely because I was honest with my lack of sleep.
Yeah. Fair enough. And they can see the dedication. So the book I spoke to you about that I wrote in the air – or broke the back of in the air, is a book on how to use storytelling in job interviews.
Has that come out yet?
No, it hasn't come out yet. It's currently with the editor on its second rewrite, but it should be out I can't give a date, but it should be out soon. I'm hoping March.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, so I can let you know that. But that is – and that was on the premise that I'm doing an online training program around that as well. So storytelling in job interviews, I think, is critical. So a lot of job interviews follow the BEI process, the behavioral event interviewing process, which is literally you know, tell me a time about when you've done this.
Yes.
And so it lends itself to stories. What a lot of people do though, is they only share business-related stories and they do it in a pretty dry way. So if you're going for a really similar job that you've had before, and if you in a similar industry, those real literal stories can work. So this is exactly when I've done it, exactly the same. But sometimes you might be swapping careers. You might be re-entering the workforce after a really long time, so after maternity leave or just a big career break, or it actually might be your first job. It's how you can use lateral stories that demonstrate your capability and demonstrate your values, but they don't necessarily have to be in a work situation. So, and it's getting a combination of those, and especially those lateral ones. I mean, if you're talking about something when you're a kid, but it shows that you have a really strong value or capability around innovation, for example, they're the ones that stand out. They're the ones that are memorable. They're the ones that people are going to connect with you, because personal stories have that effect. They actually help people connect with you and build rapport quicker, and can strengthen and build relationships a lot faster. So critical to use stories in job interviews, but you just got to be well prepared for them. And this is what the book and the online program is about, is actually taking people through the process of identifying the capabilities and the values of a job, and then trying to find the stories and match them so you go into the interview as prepared as possible.
And I guess that would be a similar process for when you're pitching for new business, if you're, you know, a consultant or in a more service-based.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Pitching for, again, the applications of story are really endless. And once you know the process and the skills and the framework, you can apply to any of these. But, yeah, pitching for new work, a lot of people go in and pitch for work and they just do all the logical stuff. So they've got their PowerPoint and they go through all the logical reasons why they should win the contract or whatever. And they go through all the things that they're going to provide. The reality is they'll have three other competitors and 95% of it will be the same.
Yeah.
So when I work with people like that, it was like I just say to them, what value of yours do you want to get across, and how can you share a personal story? You know, and it could be around a value of, is whatever it takes, I will do. You know, it's just passion for just doing, never giving up, that nothing's ever too much of an effort, or whatever it is, but share a personal story around that. Because in the end, people will work with people they want to work with. And then they will justify it with all the logic. But too often in business, we just go in with the logic, and all logic does is inform people. It doesn't influence people.
I've never used a PowerPoint presentation to pitch for new business.
No.
The thought never even crosses my mind.
But then it becomes a presentation, not a conversation.
Yeah, that's right. And it's not very good rapport building, is it? And I went into one where I was fourth of four, and they said to me, "Where's your PowerPoint presentation?" And I looked at them and went, "My what?" I thought we were just going to have a conversation. I just want to have a chat, you know, see if we're going to be the right fit. And they said, "Oh, what?" And I said, "Well, what if I don't like you?"
As you've already made yourself different and memorable.
Oh. And I got the job, and I was the most expensive. So I was very proud of that day.
Yes.
Are there any tools or tips you can suggest for people to use that might help them to collect or collate their stories?
Yeah, look, one of the things is you always start off with is the why you're sharing the story, and be really clear on what the message is or the purpose for sharing your story. So do I want to get across my value of passion for customers, or do I need to communicate a message around something? So you always start with what's the message. Then a really good way to find stories is, well, we already discussed the going through your camera roll, so looking for stories, but I call this like your story timeline, or your life on a page. Is literally, you know, grab a cup of tea, glass of wine, whatever takes your fancy, sit down with a blank piece of paper, and just from your earliest memory, jot down everything that comes to your mind. So it could be you know, starting your first day at school or falling off a bike and breaking your arm. And don't analyze why these thoughts are coming into your head. Just literally put them down. And some people go, oh, I don't even know what I thought of that. And it's really dumb and mundane, but you just put it down, you put it down, you put it down. And then when you've exhausted everything, you go back to that list and say, in a word or two, what was that about? So in a word or two, was that about persistence, or was it about resilience, or was it about risk-taking, or was it about being stupid, or was it about having a go? And then you start to build up a collection of stories that when you get in a business situation where you go, I need to find a story around persistence, you can go back to your list and go, ah, there it is. There's a perfect story I could use. So that's one way. What I do find is once people have got the skill, they just start noticing stories that they've never noticed before.
That's great. We've both just taken loads of notes, which I don't think I've done on any interview with a guest yet, because I normally listen back and take my notes.
Yeah, so that's resonated. Great. Thank you.
What is authentic leadership?
Look, authentic leadership to me is about being real. It's about being prepared to bring your whole self to your leadership. So too many times people, because they have this position of leadership, feel that they need to be bulletproof, feel they need to have all the answers, feel they can't prepare, they can't show any emotional vulnerability. And to me, real leadership isn't that. Real leadership is about, you know, showing your weaknesses just as much as your strengths. Real leadership is about saying, I don't know, have the answer for that, and inviting other people to contribute. It's, you know, people who think because they're leaders they need to be the smartest person in the room, that is such old hat thinking. You know, the smartest person in the room is the room. It's the combination of all the people in the room. So how as a leader you get that? So to me, authentic leadership or real leadership is about that. It's about bringing your whole self to work, and it's also communicating in a way that's real. So stepping away from corporate jargon and management speak and acronyms and actually saying it in a way that people connect and engage with.
Yep. And the reality of that is we can't know every single thing, can we?
No. And you
know,
especially
no leader will know absolutely everything, and if they're smart, they'll delegate and ask questions.
Yeah. And especially in this day and age with you know, technology is changing and the global environment we live in is just changing how we do business, and you know, you can't keep up with it.
Very true. So part of what you do is work with women to help them address unique challenges that women face as we progress to a more senior level of influence.
Yep.
And as we have a lot of men who listen to this podcast, can you explain what some of these challenges are and how men can be more supportive?
Yeah, look, so one of the things I do is run a program called Leadership Connection, and like you said, it does help women. Women, what I find amazing is that there's a lot of senior women coming to this room, and they're very senior. Like, I'm talking very, very senior in the corporate world. And if you looked at them, you would think they are the most amazing, confident women you've ever met, confident, capable and everything, and they are. But one of the things they always talk about is their lack of confidence. So I think as men need to be aware, especially men in leadership roles, that if they've got a team of people and, for example, they've got a position that they're advertising, that there's a lot of research that says about this, that if there's 10 things that are needed, a man will have 4 and they will go for the job. A woman will have 9 of the 10 and not go for the job because she doesn't have 10. So a woman will always be thinking, she will, and of course, you know, when we talk about gender, it's very generalized, but they will not back themselves as much as a male does. And, you know, I think the male ego accounts for that, you know, and ego is not a dirty word, but the male ego will go, I can do that. I know I've only got 4 of the 10 capabilities, but I'll learn the other 6 and I'll give it a crack. And then the woman goes, well, I've only got 9, so I'll try to get that other capability and I'll go for it next time. And the reality is if you've got all capabilities and you don't even want the job because it's not a stretch for you, so they're not putting their hat in the ring. And I think as a male leader, you need to be aware of this and you need to go tap the women on the shoulder and sometimes women need someone else to believe in them before they believe in themselves. And I'm not talking they need a male to believe in them, but they need someone else to give them a gentle push. And that's been very generalized, but I see a lot of it. They hold themselves back. I remember a friend of mine went on a really him and his wife are really, really good skiers, and Pete says by his own admission that Trish, his wife, is a far better skier than him. And they went and did this quite advanced ski thing, and the instructors made them rate their capability, and Pete put 9 out of 10 because he's actually a really, really good skier, and Trish put 8 out of 10. And then afterwards, he's going, why did you put 8 out of 10? You're better skier than me. And the instructor said, don't worry, we always add 1 to the women and we subtract 2 from the men because they always overestimate their ability.
That's fantastic. I've totally forgotten what I was going to say now, but anyway. Just with women who underestimate themselves. I found that was true when it came to getting pay rises as well. My male staff would come up to me every quarter, every 6 months, plunk down in front of me and say, I want a pay rise. And I'm like, yep, great, why? Well, yeah. I want a pay rise for blah, blah, blah reasons. And they'd give me very valid reasons as to what they'd done, why they felt they deserved it. And then we could negotiate. But with one particular organisation, not one of my female staff ever came up to me and said, I'd like a pay rise. And then, after some time where they found out that they were getting a lot less than the men for the same job and complained about it, I said, but you never once asked me for a pay rise. And they did. And it was just quite illuminating to me the difference. But the other thing I was going to say, which I've just remembered, is about probably 14 or 15 years ago, I heard Wendy McCarthy speak. And she, for listeners who don't know, Google her, she's amazing. She said to the group that many years earlier she'd been invited to be the chair of an organisation, of the board of an organisation, and she just felt that she didn't have the capabilities to do that. And she looked at the person who said to her, I think you should go for this job, we want you, and said to him, but I'm just a mum and I'm just this and I'm just that and I don't think I could do it. And he said to her, do you think you don't have the capabilities and the skills to do it, or do you think you don't have the time to do it? And she said, oh, I don't have the skills and capabilities. And he said, well, we as a board believe you do. And you need to trust our judgment because we wouldn't be asking you if you didn't think you could. And that just resonated with me so much. So now whenever anybody says to me, I think you could do A, B and C, can you give it a go? I always say yes, because I think if that person believes in me, then why don't I believe in me?
Yeah. And it's just a typical female trait where we tend not to do that. And like you said with, asking for the pay rise is a very typical female trait is, well, if I do a really good job, I will be noticed and people will give me a pay rise. Yep. And so, again, you're talking about your male listeners who have people working for them. They need to be mindful of that. And if they've got their young male guns coming up and asking for a pay rise and they get them, they should be looking at the women in their team and going over and go, oh, by the way, I've decided to give you a pay rise too. It's just the way we are. It's not right or wrong. It's the way we are.
I can remember writing to the only sort of really corporate-y sort of job I've ever had in an organisation, and writing and asking for a whole $50 a week more. And I was rewarded, no problem, but also flown down for the night and put up in a hotel and all sorts of things. So if women learn to ask, it's amazing what can actually happen.
You can, And if, if you don't ask, the answer's always no.
Exactly.
I remember the first time this is when I was still with the NAB in a corporate role, and I got – it was actually quite a senior role that I was given, and I was – given my package, and I remember thinking it was actually quite a significant jump in my package, but it wasn't, it just wasn't as much as I thought it would be. And Ironically, it was a woman who I was reporting into, and we were sitting there discussing the package, and she said, "Are you happy with this figure?" Mm. And I went, "Actually, I'm not." And she goes, "What would be more palatable to you?" And I go, "If it was an extra 10,000, I think it would be good." And she went, "Okay, done." And I just remember going, "Oh my God,
that was easy."
And you go, "Oh, I should have said 20. But it's just sometimes, you know, we just think it's harder than it is, and yep. sometimes it's just saying that this is what I think I deserve.
Yeah.
And, yep. you know, that's sometimes. It. I know a lot of women who take a role, and I say to them, this is where you've got the power, negotiate salary, yep. and they'll go, no, I'll take the job, I'll get in there, I'll do a really good job in 3 months, and then they'll realise how good I am, and they'll give me a pay rise. And I was like, good luck with that strategy.
I say, my husband got a new job recently, and I said to him, now's your opportunity to negotiate for what you want. And they'd been very clear with him throughout the process what the maximum was that they could pay, and he was happy with that. But I said to him, I want 2 weeks off at Christmas. And he said, I won't have any leave. And I went, I don't care. I want two weeks away with you at Christmas, because we haven't had a holiday together in nearly 2 years. And you're never going to get 2 weeks at Christmas if you don't ask before you say yes to the job.
Yep.
And so absolutely. I wrote the little email for him and put that and a few other things in it that I wanted him to have, and he got them all without any problem. Because he wasn't asking for anything, you know, outrageous. It was just, I've made plans. This is what that means to this job.
If they had said, we don't care what plans you've made with your family, you're not having them, it's a company he doesn't want to work for. So it's best to find that out
that
from
the
start. That
has happened to him before. He got offered a job a couple of years ago, and they said to him, you can start, and they offered him the job on Friday and said, you can start on Monday, can't you? And he said, actually, we're going away for a family holiday for a week tomorrow. I can start the following Monday. And they said, no, you need to start on Monday. And he said, well, I can't. And they said, well, then the job's not yours. See you later. Mm-hmm. And he was gutted because he'd been unemployed for a while. And I just said to him, you would not want to work for a firm like that.
No.
Because if they're not prepared to compromise on giving you a week's later starting date because of a long-standing commitment with a family holiday, they're not going to let you leave work at 3:30 every second Friday to go and coach your kids' football team.
No, exactly.
And he went, oh, yeah, okay, that's a good point.
Yeah. Mm.
So apart from the book that's coming out in March or soon.
March-ish. God, did
March-ish.
I just say that?
March. Yeah. Okay, let's make a game of it.
Let's make a game. I'll put it out there.
Mind you, I guess it's out of your hands if it's with an editor and you're having
with
to go
an editor.
Through.
Yeah. There's a couple of things that just need to line up before push the publish go live on it,
but apart from that, do you have any other big goals for 2016?
Yeah, look, 2016 there will probably be another book on the horizon. I'm hoping to head off to Harvard again this year, so always like to do a little bit of professional development. The last time I went to Harvard, it was on adaptive leadership, but this program specifically around women and power, so which may be the basis of the new book. I'm planning to do a lot more keynote speaking this year, so got an inquiry to speak at a conference in Boston in October, so that'll be exciting if that happens. So just as you talked about, Jason has three projects. We, at Thought Leaders, we think of, you know, you have three words for the year, a word for the month, a word for the quarter, a word for the year. And so my word for the month is fitness. So I'm really focusing on a bit of fitness after, you know, 6 weeks of Christmas drinking.
Cheer.
Christmas cheer. And my word for the quarter is leverage. So how do I leverage my business? And that's the reason why I'm focusing on all the online programs. And my word for the year is showtime, which to me is just a real step up.
You
know, imagine if you put your mind to it, what you could really achieve and do. So, and it's just also when you're thinking of doing something, just do it. So, you know, and that's on a personal level too. So, for example, last Friday night we were sitting there and the family was there and something came on about Hobart, and we've been to Tassie a couple of times and the kids go, we should go back to Tasmania one day. And I go, well, we should. I go, we should maybe just fly over for Hobart for a long weekend. So, you know, that night I just booked it. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
The long weekend's coming up. It's, you know, a few days after my birthday. So I just thought, oh, here's a good reason for any. And so, yeah, that's what Showtime to me is. Just do it.
Lovely. Yeah, I like it. Yeah, it's great. So finally, what is your top tip for our listeners to get stuff done?
Get stuff done. I think
you're going to say just do it, aren't you?
Yeah, so. Well, one of the things is when something comes in, get it off your desk really quickly. So like people say, you know, can you write a testimonial for me? I just do it straight away. I try to not leave meetings with work. So the biggest time waster is when you can meet with someone and then, you know, so I suppose you're going to send a proposal, and we can talk about price here, we can talk about everything. I mean, I do have something I send in writing, but I have a standard line of I don't do proposals under 100,000. So unless it's a really, really big piece of work, I'm not going to do a proposal.
I'm taking that.
And the other thing is, if it's not your core thing, don't do it. So, you know, I run my practice and I have an executive manager, and my job is to think stuff, you know, to write, to think about it, to sell it, and then to deliver it. And anything out of that, I do not do. So just outsource as much as you can. And, you know, not everyone has the luxury of having a manager and assistant, but some people do, and you've got to let go and go, okay, they're really good at that stuff, so let them do that, and you stick to what you're really good at, and just outsource as much as you can. And even on a personal thing, don't, like I said before, you know, don't make the bed when you can close the door. So.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much. That was a fantastic conversation, and I've got lots of ideas for moving forward. I love the word of the month, word of the quarter, and word of the year. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard that before. I'm familiar with the word of the year, but I like the month and the quarter as well.
I have to give credit to Matt Church, who's the founder of Thought Leaders Global, for that. But, it's what he encourages us all to do.
That's clever. I like that. Before we go, how can our listeners connect with you?
Yeah, so, on my website, so www.gabrielledolan.com, and that'll have, you know, all the information on the books and the online programs when they become available. But through LinkedIn and Twitter is the main things. But, yeah.
We'll put the links in our show notes so that people can easily find them.
Yep, excellent.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Gabrielle.
For us too. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Activity Pod. Continue the conversation over at theactivitypod.com, where you'll find the show notes and all the other fantastic episodes, together with links to our Facebook page, facebook.com/theactivitypod, or tweet us at @theactivitypod, where you'll find Annette and Mel every day. Theactivitypod.com is also a place where you can connect with Annette and Mel directly. Thanks for joining us today as we find better ways to help you focus, become more productive, and get stuff done so that you can gain greater freedom to choose what you want from life. We'd love you to join us in our next episode, where we look forward to helping you with accountability so that you can get stuff done.